now, you know, somebody's selling an algorithm, right? So if you're the OEM and you're counting on that algorithm to maintain your brand quality, right? How do you acceptance test that algorithm? Especially if you're like an automotive engineer, not somebody with decades of software experience. Like, how do you begin to do that? It's an interesting problem.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome back to Going Deep with Aaron Watson. Today's episode is with Michael Wagner, the co-founder and CEO of Edge Case Research. Edge Case Research is involved in the autonomous vehicle self-driving space, but unlike a lot of the other companies that you're probably familiar with that are responsible for delivering an end solution to the problem of moving vehicles without human drivers, Michael's company cuts horizontally across all those companies to create standards, software tools, and recommendations around optimizing for safety as these solutions are being built. In this episode, we talk not only about Michael's background learning from the icons of autonomous driving at CMU, but also the business model of his company and the process by which his team works together to create the standards by which these autonomous vehicles are evaluated. I am certain that you are going to learn something from listening to this conversation. I know that I walked away with a lot of things to think about. Here is Michael Wagner.
You're listening to Going Deep with Aaron Watson.
All right, Mike.
Hi, Aaron.
Thank you so much for hosting us in your office. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. I appreciate your interest in what we're up to.
So your company popped up. I was talking with Jackie before. There's an article about these, you know, exciting tech companies, exciting startups in the city of Pittsburgh. And I like to think of myself as someone who's like, you know, on top of the pulse and knows everything that's happening. I had not heard of you guys before.
Oh.
And so I started doing some research. It was fascinating because there's so many through lines about the different narratives of Pittsburgh, robotics, autonomous vehicles, you know, spin-outs from CMU and the other technical schools around here. So yep. I want to start things off with folks who might be in a similar boat to me, not familiar with Edge Case Research. Can you talk a little bit about what the company does and some of and the business model that underpins your work?
Sure thing. So we're a very mission-focused company. Most of us came to this company because we're interested in making autonomy that's safe. Because autonomy is not very useful if you can't count on it, if you don't trust it. And so we'd spent a lot of time designing technical approaches, but also business approaches and organizational approaches to being able to help our customers get safer designs, to test more effectively, and to put everything together in what we call a live safety case. So, you know, our slogan is that we help deliver the promise of autonomy because we can help everyone in the whole industry be able to get to market with safer, faster, you know, vehicles. And yeah, so our business model is one of helping the whole industry. So we offer products that that developers use to be able to build their systems in a safer way. We offer products that help monitor the safety of their systems in a standards compliant way. And we've been really excited about it because we can help solve some very big but common challenges across several industries.
And another part of that, it's interesting you said standards because, you know, there's long held standards around how a human-driven vehicle might go through the roads or how a train might travel across rail tracks. But when we start talking about autonomy and whether that's on, you know, the roads that the general population uses or in a mine or in some of these different arenas, those kind of have to be reimagined with the constraints and the capabilities of the technology in mind. So can you talk a little bit more about like what those standards look like, if you're like starting with something and reshaping it, or if you're trying to build it from the ground up, like what goes into something like
that? It's really challenging because historically safety critical systems, you know, like stuff that's in charge of rail systems or nuclear systems or, you know, controllers in aircraft, they've been a lot simpler than autonomous vehicles. The technology is better understood. And so one of the things that we have to do is really define safety for these new kinds of domains. And you mentioned some of it is how the vehicles behave. We have to specify all that. But a lot of it is also how the software is built. We're really trying to enable software to be built in a new way, in a way that is able to be verified. It's not just fast and kind of thrown out and maybe we see if it works. It's that it's considered but and analyzed very, very closely. And we think this is going to open up a lot of new capabilities for society, because if you can build software that's big and complicated and that you can trust, you can do some really powerful things. So a lot of new standards have needed to be developed. We have a standard called UL 4600 that we helped with. It just came out in April. It is the world's first standard that basically says how you evaluate the safety of an autonomous product. We're very proud of it. It's kind of a weird trajectory for a startup to write, you know, a global standard like that. But we have the right team, and it's really been adopted in a big way by the market.
And so can you talk a little bit, like going back to the origins of a company like this, you know, the edge case research, It's even in the name, right?
Yeah.
And I always compliment companies where the name is at least in some way implies what the work is, and it's not just some, you know, unidentifiable word.
It's hard to do, yeah.
but really, you know, if you've ever seen, and I'm not an expert at it, but I've seen a few of the screens basically representing everything that a computer vision software might be taking in, and there's a person standing at the corner, and there's a tree, and there's a signpost, and there's the actual parking sign, and this, that, and three other vehicles moving around on a motorcycle, and it's able to take this all in and try to identify it. And the edge case is really, you know, the thing that is not easily definable. So, a woman with brown pants and a green top, and it gets identified as a tree versus
someone in a wheelchair whose shape and outline is really much different than somebody who walks on two legs. Yeah, it's really, thank you, first of all. It's challenging to name a company, especially as an engineer. Sometimes it can be very challenging. But, yeah, I mean, that's what also interested it about me, right, is that, you know, I'd been building autonomy for a long time at Carnegie Mellon. I was involved in constructing the autonomous vehicles and algorithms. We did a lot of different kinds of things. And I got really curious about how you would be able to trust these things. And I met Phil Koopman, my co-founder, and he gave me a lot of very interesting anecdotal information from what had gone wrong in other kinds of industries. And it's really always about the unexpected.
Yeah,
that, you know, if something bad happens, it's because you didn't plan on it, right? And so, you know, when you look at that in the world of autonomy, that's a really interesting question. What's unexpected to a AI-driven system? So it's a very intellectually interesting thing, and it turns out it's also a very economically interesting thing too, because these cars right now are counting on these kinds of technologies to be accurate and correct across different populations of pedestrians and different conditions. So it's a great problem to be working on.
And so let's go a little bit more into the past to catch back up to the present. So there's all sorts of routes, you know, part of the reason that the vehicles are traveling our roads and not maybe some other similar size metropolises around the country is because of the routes with CMU, the DARPA competition, Red Whitaker. There's a kind of long lineage here. So can you talk a little bit about those past experiences and kind of when the jumping off point to start your own thing happened? Because we talked to Brian Selesky, he went to Google and then bounced off to his own thing, and we've kind of seen these similar type of arcs where you were there. I don't want to call it maybe you think about it, the genesis. It was kind of just,
that's accurate. Yeah, no, I think that CMU was a magical place to be. You know, I went to school there in the 90s. I started working in robotics because somebody was giving a lecture about a moon robot, and I just thought that was the coolest thing around. So I was working on computer engineering, like CPU design, prior to that. I thought it was a really interesting topic, and I was really lucky because at the same time I was doing that, there was this group of smart and visionary people who were converging at CMU, and a lot of people give a lot of credit to Red Whitaker, but And he deserves it. And the reason I think he deserves it is because he forced all of us to think about the system, to think about the application. We weren't just working on one small algorithmic problem. We were worried about, you know, how big the impact of this system was going to be on the world. What kind of problem did it solve? And he wanted us all to solve big problems.
Yeah.
And so I think that set people up to be leaders in this industry, because if you look at a lot of the successful leaders, guys like Chris Urmson and Brian Selesky and everything else, they have a lot of experience solving end-to-end problems. And I think that's really paid off. So, being around at the right time was amazing. I'm really lucky to have been, friends with many of those people and to have been involved in a number of really amazing things. And, I was around when the Grand Challenge was going on, when these things were stepping up and becoming more and more real. And that was actually when I started getting really interested in safety and trust, because as these things get real, it's like, oh, gosh, well, we got to figure all these, you know, we got to answer all these questions.
Yeah. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my kind of intuition here is I can imagine someone with, we all have different predispositions, right? Like I tend to talk with my hands. Some people tend to be aesthetically oriented. And if you have some sort of predisposition or orientation around the safety of these things, and you're just kind of fascinated by it and thinking through it, at some point you have to say to yourself, well, there's a gap here. Like, look at this hole. There's a hole. Like, here's the ecosystem, and there's, you know, Google throwing more money than anyone else at the problem. And like we can categorize everything, but there's this hole here that I'm seeing, and I have to act upon it. Like, can you take me more through that part of the story?
Yeah, and I mean, this is why we started the company instead of just doing more research, is because that hole that you described is kind of a cultural problem. It's not a technical problem.
Interesting.
And it's because you have people that are super smart and super experienced in safety engineering, masters of the field, right? They are top-notch. They're smart. They'll get you right to your solution. They are a totally different group of people, at least until the past couple of years. They've been a totally different group of people than the autonomy and machine learning and AI people.
Interesting.
And sometimes they don't even know how to talk to each other. Many of them do not speak the same language. And that's the problem that I'm really interested in solving, because if that can be solved, I mean, everything takes off, right? I mean, all the future that we imagine with like amazing automation, and the future that we fear, like Skynet and everything, doesn't happen, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's the core of what we're trying to do.
Fascinating. So if we kind of get into that a little bit more, we've kind of alluded to this categorization problem and, hey, is this a tree or a person? Is this a dog or a lamppost or whatever it may be?
Yep.
Another thing from my reading is that there are different kind of fundamental approaches to autonomy that different companies are taking. And I'm not going to ask you to talk specifically on any company, but a lot of them are using LiDAR.
Yep.
And there's other systems, radar, stereo cameras, you know, using something
map
more like
data. There's all kinds of different things.
Yeah. Yep. Can you basically take us through an inventory of those things?
Sure.
And then if you can, to a layman, kind of explain how they kind of fit together in this, because it's rare that companies, from my reading, that are just like using one solution. There's a couple, but like most of them are kind of blending these together in order to accomplish the goal.
Well, look, I'm a robotics guy myself, and so I look at it as a challenge. I drive down the road with my eyes. I don't have radar or LiDAR, but I think that I think that's why some people think that way, and that's an interesting thought experiment.
Yeah.
But you know, usually, if you look at it from a safety engineering standpoint, each of those sensing modalities, as they would be called, each of them has their own failure rates and failure modes. So the failure rates are important to think about because, you know, maybe your camera can't see something or your camera goes out. So that's good. I got a radar, I got a LiDAR, I got map data coming in, right? So some of it is just the redundancy that you need to get to a really safety critical system. And also it's important to keep in mind that many of these cars have multiple cameras, multiple, you know, radar and things like that. So there's some diversity there. It's a safety net, right?
Right.
So, but then the other thing is that if you break the problem down more, then you start to see that certain kinds of perception are good for certain kinds of things and maybe not so good for others. So like reading signs, right? That's a very visual thing. Understanding what that blob is in front of you, right? That's a very visual kind of thing. The range detection and, you know, maybe that's something that's much better for a LiDAR. Radar tells you how fast the objects are moving in addition to just where they are. It gives you that data right back with Doppler calculations. So map data tells you, you know, yet another kind of thing. So you have to think about it at a kind of fine-grained level to really understand. But fundamentally, one of the things is that use the different sensing modalities to get more coverage, to get more safety, you know, to get a more reliable system.
So to use an imperfect metaphor here, if you think about traditional car safety, we've got an airbag and we've got brakes and we've got a seatbelt because they all kind of play different roles in the safety of the passenger in the case of an accident or something occurring, or hopefully the brakes can prevent the accident. But
yeah. But I mean, usually that's the safety approach, is that you have multiple things that you're trying to apply to the problem to just be as safe as possible.
Right.
So some of that is the case here. Yeah.
Okay, and so similar like with COVID, there's the masks and there's the social
distance
and there's the washing the hands, and it's not that like one solves the problem and that, well, I wash my hands so therefore I can come over and give you a hug or something. Like that's not the same idea.
That's fair. Yep. But again, it's a complicated problem, right? It's not one that's immediately solvable because like I said, you know, telling, I don't know, what kind of text or what message is on the sign, is not something that a LiDAR can do typically. Of course, there are people working on that sort of thing. I'm simplifying, but you know, if you want to read the text, you have to look at what the image is saying.
Yeah.
So sometimes you don't have those multiple levels of redundancy. And that's really where a lot of the challenges are. And the people in the industry understand that very, very well.
Yeah. So another thing that I've always wondered about, and safety seems like it would be part and parcel to this, is the framework that I've said is, you know, as soon as these self-driving vehicles are statistically proven to be safer than a human driver, like, we should let them run. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of, on your face, like, okay, that logically makes sense, but humans, and we've seen it with, you know, anytime there is an accident with, like, one of the, you know, the multitude of different vehicles, they've all had different forms of accidents. The reaction to that is far from rational and balanced and logical from that specific lens. So obviously the end point, if we look all the way down the thing, if we could, you know, create an extinction event for autonomous, for vehicle fatalities, that would be fantastic. But we recognize the enormity, you know, the enormous complexity of eventually getting there.
Yeah.
Is there like a flag that you plant in the ground for like a, this would be a really meaningful milestone that would kind of signal a step change in that space?
Yeah. That's a really good question. So, you know, I think that these things can be done incrementally. I think they're supposed to, because that's how you manage them, right? So one of the key pieces in that equation is more than just the statistics. It's the agreement of how you're supposed to do it, what the standards need to be. So if you look at like what safety standards are used for aircraft equipment, like let's say we're building an aircraft engine.
Yeah.
The standard for the software that we're writing for that engine doesn't really talk often about statistics. It's talking about how you build it right. It's saying, you know, people who write code without bugs do all these things. And we know that there's no bugs in the code because we've looked at it really closely according to these processes and activities. So I think that's actually a thing we can start to do now, right? Even if your claim is, hey, I'm still not as good as a human driver, but I'm, you know, I'm pretty good, and here's my goal, and here's the argument I can give you for why I've met that goal, right? And yeah, by the way, everyone in the industry is pretty happy with this because we've all pitched in and said, yeah, these are the best practices, and here I'm following all of them. That would be great, because it's not just about statistics, it's about trust. And trust is that I'm running my organization the right way. I have a good safety culture. I have, you know, trained engineers. All these kinds of things need to go into that safety communication.
Makes sense. And I tend to keep using metaphors, so I'll keep that up. But like, you know, statistically, if the seawall hasn't been surpassed in New Orleans, uh-huh. but, you know, it's coming up just a couple inches from the
you
crest.
You got a problem.
Yeah, we're at the precipice of a problem. And even if statistically it's like, well, we've had zero,
right.
you know, floods in whatever period of time, that you kind of have to think about it on a more, on a longer time horizon than that.
Yeah, yeah. And you also have to look very closely. I mean, that's the other thing that's the other aspect of what you just said, is that you don't just say like, all right, this box hasn't been checked yet, or this
yeah.
seawall hasn't been breached. It's like, wow, we got 3 feet of clearance and then we're going to have a problem. Let's think ahead. Oh yeah, that might be an issue. We should take care of it now, right? And that's what safety culture is about.
So when you're saying these things of how some of these other autonomous engineers and some of these characters, it is like speaking a different language from the safety engineer.
Yep.
How do you manage the tension of that in these organizations that you and your team are probably coming in there with this mandate of like, we're trying to optimize for safety. We're trying to optimize for you know, these ways that we evaluate things.
Yep.
At the other end of the spectrum, you could have all the way up to like investors and an executive pushing to say like, you know, I told the market that we would be, you know, autonomous by this point in time, or, you know, we had set whatever arbitrary internal deadline.
Sure.
And like, you're basically having engineers sit in the middle of those two opposing forces.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that is. But I think that's not unique to safety. You know, I think the business side of it has the same problem. Having now become an entrepreneur, previously being a researcher, I think I've realized that one of the things that's important for startups in this space is that they have a safety roadmap, right? So like, if you and I are starting a startup, we need to think about TAM, right? Total addressable market. We need to be like pointed towards something that if we're successful, it's going to be big, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, why start the company? Same thing with tech, right? If you don't, like, the first standard for autonomy safety came out what, 4 months ago now, okay? But there's been a lot of work, right? What were all of, you know, what was that investment moving towards? You need to have a story for how you're actually going to overcome some of those barriers, and you're going to meet some of those objectives. And it's not, I think the industry now is definitely the point where they know it's not just through demos and through, you know, one-off kind of, you know, feature demonstrations. It's about, you need to have standards, you need to have a plan, you need to have a roadmap, and all that needs to be thought about since day one, because you can make decisions at the very beginning when you're a super small startup that make that a lot easier, right? And so that's kind of how we're trying to solve that problem. Because then if you get down the road, maybe you have a technical problem. I mean, nobody's perfect, right? But that's the same thing on the business side. Maybe there's like some product market fit that you didn't anticipate. So you've gone out and tried to learn about it and you tweak the approach. But it's definitely not like a wall that you have, that you can keep not climbing until you get another round of funding. You got to be thinking about it from day one.
Yeah. You've been thinking about it from day one with the scaling of this company. And as you bring your kind of engineering team online at this company, how have you selected for those characters? Because you want the safety predisposition.
Yep.
But if there is that gap between those kind of two types of engineers and needing to be able to translate that, yep. Like, have you found yourself almost needing to hire in their direction as much as you need them to come in yours?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have both. We have, you know, over the summer, we set up an office in Munich. And the folks in that office, just like a lot of folks from CMU, are experts in deep learning and experts in autonomy. So we need to have both, because we need to have these problems figured out internally before we go out into the world and tell people that we know better.
Yeah.
Right? Because if we haven't tried to solve that problem, then that we don't really know better. So in terms of the kind of people we try to find here, we like to look for people who are smart, helpful, and friendly. And we intentionally use those words at the company because we're trying to find solutions. So we're trying to be helpful and friendly about it. But we also, like, they're tough problems. So we need to be intellectually truthful and honest, because if I come and try to find a simple solution to a complicated safety problem, that's a serious fail. And that's not something that we're ever going to do. So we need to have people that are able to look at it both sort of, you know, as in terms of inventing new things, but they trust each other and work with each other well enough so that we can also constructively criticize those things and make sure that they're aligned in the right direction. And this all really started with me and my co-founder.
Yeah.
This is really the way that our relationship developed, because I count on Phil for guiding us and aligning us. And I think we work really well together because we can create and analyze at the same time. And that's pretty cool.
Were there moments where you felt like you peeled back a layer of like, man, we can go even deeper? Like, not that I can cut deeper is not the right analogy, but like, I can really like deeply criticize something and we can bounce back from it, because that
is
the trust that we've kind of built as business partners.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of what I do is I say, hey, I think this is what the first set of features or whatever should be, or this is what the customer really needs or whatever. And Phil's an amazing guy. I definitely recommend that you chat with him sometimes too. And he'll be spot on, right? He'll say, yep, but here's what they're not thinking about. And I guarantee you that if we move down this path, then this is the problem that they're really trying to solve. And it's orthogonal maybe to what I was thinking, but it's always been extraordinarily helpful. So, I mean, I guess if Phil and I can get along, right, the whole industry could get along, because we're a microcosm of that autonomy versus safety engineering pattern that we were talking about.
And from a leadership standpoint, how do you get, I don't know if it might be conscious, it might not be, but modeling that type of disagreement and you know, coming back together afterwards, or just, you know, doing it in a kind of unemotional, just, you know, analytical way. Is it important to you to model that for the team so that they can then kind of absorb that ethos and that style of communication?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you're coming from certain organizations and certain company cultures that are really focused on go, 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 then there's not a lot of room for disagreement. People got to come into line. And that makes sense if you're doing something that's well understood and you're just trying to get over the finish line as fast as possible. We started this company a little over six years ago. So we've been around for a while, longer than I even imagined. We've been around for a little while because these problems are hard, and we want to make sure that we're solving the key problems. And really the only way to do that is to have that comfort and to model that to everyone, because now we're 60 people. And so there are a lot of important decisions being made you know, that I'm not even really directly involved in. And so it's important that people understand that they have that space. And again, that's why smart, helpful, and friendly is a good way to think about it. Because if ultimately you realize that person is coming from a constructive place, then you're going to get along with him or her.
Gotcha.
And that's been hard, I got to say, over the past 7 months is like everybody's remote.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like last year in 2019, I spent a lot of time going over to Germany to set up our operations in Munich. And we had a lot of really like in-depth work over there. It's kind of the away team. You know, it actually brought me back to like early at Carnegie Mellon. I worked on these projects with Red Whitaker, and we'd go to Antarctica and go to, you know, Chile and different places like that. And it was always kind of fun, like being the away team. And it's been kind of tough with everybody remote, but we got good people, so I'm happy about how that's working, you know, despite all that.
Makes sense. As we think about autonomy, and you know, for me being a Pittsburgher, like I see certain different vehicles drive around the streets, and that's where it feels relevant, and you know, not close to being tangible.
No, yeah, right. It's not just a TechCrunch, page image or something. Yeah,
right. But you're talking about going to Antarctica. You know, even in doing more research for this, like this also applies to mining.
Sure.
You know, autonomy has been a part of airline travel for a long time, people are aware of it or not.
Yep.
Where else do you see this really being transformative that folks that aren't actually paying close attention to the space of autonomy might not necessarily appreciate?
Sure. Well, the first place to look is in trucking. Because there's incredible efficiency gains to be made there. The economics of that business is favorable to being able to start to smartly incorporate autonomy. And so you have a lot of big companies in that space. Package delivery and whatnot is something a lot of people are talking about, especially now as the demand for that has gone through the roof. If you could scale that out using some kind of automation, there'd be a lot of benefits there. And from a safety perspective, you know, a smaller, more manageable robot is maybe easier to get to market in a safe way. So that's kind of cool.
Not necessarily going to do as much damage, and it's not a huge deal if they're traveling 5 miles per hour versus 40 on a highway.
Exactly. That's right. Mining is a big one. You touched on that. I think agriculture is another really big one. There's a tremendous level of automation that is possible, and really thinking of a farm as a factory and fitting in consistent, reliable automation into that is probably going to be very beneficial to society and, of course, to the providers.
And those, both mining and agriculture, to me, both seem like places where we're almost like trying to get the people out of there anyway. It's like
sure.
Not maybe 100, maybe eventually 100%, but like the kind of aspiration is, you know, it used to be most people were farming and then it's like 3% of the population and then
right.
even less. And similarly with these mining, like it's the, you know, we had the issue with like the folks that were caved in. And
mining's dangerous.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Exceptionally dangerous. So if we can get people out of there, that means people are safer.
Well, yeah, robotics, again, this is a CMU thing. You know, we want to apply robotics to dirty, dull, and dangerous jobs, right? And so, you know, there's certainly driving down the road in Lawrenceville is maybe not dangerous or dirty anymore. Maybe a little bit dull when you're stuck in the traffic, but certainly like mining and ag have a lot of those benefits that we can get out of it. But really, there's a lot of different things. I mean, you know, drones we haven't even talked about. There's a lot of applications that I think we haven't even started to imagine yet that if you could really, really trust autonomy, you'd be able to have huge, huge benefits.
Yeah. Two last questions, and then we'll aim towards wrapping up with our final questions. Does the industry, I don't know if you think about autonomy as an industry unto itself or if it's kind of...
No, it's a technology that serves a number of different business needs.
So does it feel...
Which is crazy because it came out of CMU. It was all about the robotics itself. But really, the interesting thing is what you do with it.
Yeah. So does it feel like a small world to you in the sense that, like, you know Chris, who founded Aurora. You know Brian, who founded Argo. And so many of these characters, whether they're at Waymo and all these other places, they all kind of came from either, like, Stanford or CMU. Does it have that kind of sense to you as an insider?
Yes, definitely. It's a small world. I like to joke because a lot of people talk about, well, is what Edgecase doing, is it applicable to everyone? And I like to joke that there are only so many robotics professors that everybody learned from.
Yeah.
And they really don't teach that much differently. So, it is definitely a small world for now. It's nice to see people without strictly a robotics background come into it for the cultural reasons that we talked about.
Yeah.
Because, you know, without getting into too many, like, weird details, like, there are some ways that robotics experts think about the world that maybe aren't optimal for certain kinds of problems that you need to solve. And so it's nice to get everybody, people with a lot of product background, people with like broad software engineering, you know, UX factors and all the organizational aspects, how you turn it into a product and a business. It's really cool to see all these pieces come together, but it's definitely still small.
Yeah, because it clicked for me when we were talking with Brian and he was just kind of talking about like, yeah, I was at Google and then like I know the person over here and over there.
Yeah,
it's like,
it's
a relatively small world. And I would imagine in certain instances, maybe less so specifically with edge case, but it seems like there's a lot of potential for it to be competitive if you're splintering off and there is that more of like the race factor, like we talk about trying to get to that end result.
I'm sure it is. And that's got to be tough. That's been one of the things I've liked about edge case is that we're really trying to help everybody. And we want to see, I mean, our business model counts on the industry succeeding. So that's been a nice place to be as there's been all this competitive activity.
Yeah. And the last question, and this isn't even that big, but it's, you know, a term that I wasn't particularly familiar with, but OEMs is this idea that, you know, we have these brands, Ford, Chevrolet, that make a car, but there's all this whole
supply chain
of providers from like the little widget to the tire to all the way through. And they're basically assembling and designing that final product. It seems like another way to think about edge case potentially is if there is that same sort of life cycle, the same way you're not actually making the physical LiDAR detector and right. iterating that on a regular basis, you're kind of coming in at this specific safety layer.
Right.
And if, you know, all these companies are creating these vertical brands, you're horizontally going across them, yeah. being able to provide that solution.
Yeah, we don't make the LiDAR. We make the LiDAR. are safer, to quote a phrase. Yeah, no, I mean, that's one of the advantages of kind of where we are. Some people say we're, you know, selling picks and shovels to the gold miners. I like your way of thinking of it better because it does show that we are dealing with people in different parts of a supply chain. And actually, even the way they communicate with each other now involves safety a lot more than it used to, right? If you were just selling a brake pedal, you had the spec, right? You built to the spec, you showed that it took, you know, somebody mashing down on it without breaking.
Yeah.
And then that's an acceptance test. And now, you know, somebody's selling an algorithm, right? So if you're the OEM and you're counting on that algorithm to maintain your brand quality, right? How do you acceptance test that algorithm? Especially if you're like an automotive engineer, not somebody with decades of software experience. Like, how do you begin to do that? It's an interesting problem.
Yeah. Fascinating. Well, Mike, I appreciate you coming on here and sharing so much about the autonomous space. Before we ask our standard last two questions, is there anything else you were just hoping to share about autonomous vehicles, safety, edge case research I didn't give you a chance to?
Sure. I think that we're in a really exciting time. I think this is something that you've kind of seen ebbs and flows of investment, enthusiasm, stories about these things. I guess I did want to send the message that, starting a couple years ago, the industry really did start to take all of these things. I mean, they always took them seriously, but you could really see it mature and grow. And we're seeing a number of these standards come out of all that kind of activity. And those things are paying off. The maturity of this industry really is accelerating. And I think it's getting to the point where there's going to be some super exciting things in the not too distant future.
Right on. Well, I can't wait to see it happen, and I'm glad that it'll be a little bit safer because of edge case research. For folks that want to learn more, follow along with everything that you guys are doing, what digital coordinates can we provide for people?
Yep, so we're on LinkedIn. We're pretty active on there. And also, you can go to our website, which is www.ecr.ai.
Right on. We're going to link that in the show notes for folks. It is available in the podcast app where you're probably listening to it right now or at goingdeepwitharon.com/podcast for every single episode of the show. Before we let Michael go, I'm going to give him the mic one final time to issue an actionable personal challenge for the audience.
Yeah. So earlier on, I was talking about going to see that lunar robot seminar. Take the time out of your day to go see that lunar robot seminar because it can really change what you're thinking about, expand kind of the way you're thinking about things and try to connect different disciplines wherever you are because a lot of really interesting innovation comes from that. So it's a little bit abstract, but I think it's great advice.
But it is those grand projects that yeah. rally people around something to, you know, extend the even imagination of what they can do. Like you said,
absolutely.
With Red, like thinking in these grand, big systems is how you actually start to see more of the board.
And by starting to do it, yeah. And it's and you won't be disappointed. Even if it doesn't work out, you'll learn a ton. So,
right on. Mike, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
We just went deep with Michael Wagner. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day. Thank you so
so much for listening to the end of my conversation with Michael. I would encourage you, if you have not yet listened to them, to check out our past interviews with self-driving vehicle entrepreneurs Chetan Marichli of Locomation AI and Brian Selesky of Argo AI. This is one of the potentially transformative technologies of the next 20 years. It's worth understanding, worth contemplating the timeline upon which it may arrive and the impacts that it could have on our society. Hoping to have more like these soon. Thanks for keeping it tuned to Going Deep with Aaron Watson.
Thanks for listening. Connect with Aaron on Twitter and Instagram at AaronWatson59.